Cardboard Philosophy, the board game podcast where we talk about nothing serious, seriously. Each episode, we randomly pick from a list of niche, deep board game topics and have at it. So we invite you to join us at the table, listen in on our conversations, and let us know what you think. Welcome back to Cardboard Philosophy. This is episode 28 of 29. So, next episode... Next episode is our last one, everybody. It's been a great run.
I think we've made that joke every week for the last, like, 27 weeks.
I haven't made that joke.
Oh, okay.
But I'm your glad turn. Somebody
you
was
got
making
the first
it.
Player marker?
Yes. You know what we do here? We roll dice and then talk about topics. And if we ever name a Kinesia game, we ding at it. That's all there is to know. So I'm going to roll the die. And we got 24... End game triggers. This is a topic from Mr. Evan, so take it away.
Yeah, so really the origin of this topic was just when we were talking about Oath a couple of weeks ago and how that is decided by a dice roll. So that's an end game trigger that is either caused by time or by luck. Can an end game trigger caused by luck be satisfying? How do end game triggers affect our emotional response to the game? What kind of end game triggers are there? It's just something that I think is in every game we play to some degree, but it's not necessarily something we talk about a ton.
If we're just categorizing end game triggers, I think the two two categories I think of immediately are player driven and non-player driven end game triggers. So a player driven end game trigger is something that the players can affect. Like, for example, if there's a bag of tiles and you have a choice of how many you're drawing or how many you're discarding or whatever, and the game ends when the bag of tiles runs out, the players have a direct effect on that timing.
Yeah.
Or it could just be 12 rounds, and it's like, you can't do anything about it. You're playing 12 rounds. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's a spectrum. Sometimes it's very much in the player's hands. Other times it's not. Or somewhere in the middle where it's going to be about 12 rounds, but the players can maybe do something to make it 13 or 11. So there's certainly a spectrum there, but those are the first two categories that pop into my mind when talking about endgame triggers.
I definitely think the set number of rounds is one of the easiest ones to grok because it's very clearly delineated on the board usually. We have 8 rounds and then the game is over. As opposed to something where it can go an indeterminate number of rounds. Those ones are almost always player-driven as far as when the game end is going to trigger. But it's a lot more nebulous, especially for new players or for first couple of games, to kind of figure the timing out, because a more seasoned player is going to know, because you know these actions keep getting taken, that's going to accelerate the end game. But someone who's just coming into the game might go, oh, I'm just going to keep doing this action, you know, for an hour and it's going to be fine.
I think that's a different axis though, because there's player driven or player controlled and non-player controlled, but I think fixed and variable is a different axis. Like if it's player driven, it will be variable, but there's other ways to make it variable without it being player driven. Like sometimes some card draws will determine the end game, right? And it's not, there's no choice. You have to flip a tile every round.
Yeah.
So it's slightly different.
Like high society.
Ding.
Uh-huh. Ding. Excellent.
Or,
yeah.
I mean, in Oath, I imagine that you don't just immediately start rolling dice to see if the game ends. Like, it's after round, like, I don't know. Is it, like,
it's after 4 rounds.
X rounds? Okay, so it's still just sort of fixed, but then it becomes variable, but it's not player-controlled. It's random. It's a dice roll.
Yeah, so maybe there's three categories. There's fixed, there's variable through player actions, and then there's variable through randomness, right? Mm-hmm. Those are like the three categories.
I think I would agree with that. I wonder if there's a fourth one we're going to discover over the course
of
the conversation.
There is.
Oh, what is it?
Unending.
Oh, we've already found it.
It's unending, like just one. Or a lot of those party games, right? Like
Monopoly.
You just keep going until you're done.
Yeah, or I mean, obviously those games end, but it's not like there's a moment where you like, it just kind of fizzles out. Not even fizzles. It's just where you decide to be done.
Yeah.
Which is kind of player-driven, I guess. But I get the distinction for sure.
Yeah, I feel like it's in a very loose way.
Yeah, it's like,
it's not player-driven. It's like there's you, the person at the table, and then you're embodying some player. Mm-hmm. And in the games that they're player-driven, it's like the player is the one driving it. Whereas in these party games, it's really like there is no player you're embodying. You're just yourself, kind of, because you're writing down words, yeah. right? You're not like, I'm a person from Amsterdam sailing the Mediterranean or whatever. There's none of that. So it's like human or person driven, which is different than player driven. But maybe we're getting really semantic now.
That's I don't know if we're getting semantic, because to your point, a party game really usually is more of a social experience than something like a Euro game, where even a Euro game, the thematics of it are usually kind of super glued onto the mechanics to a unreasonable degree at times. I think the variable is one of the more exciting endgame triggers, because it's unpredictable, right? Like, there's going to be factors that you can kind of look at and say, you know, the game is likely going to end soon, but it's not necessarily a guarantee. I think Ethnos does that in a really cool way, where you have this deck of cards that you're constantly drawing from, but the further into the deck you go, the more likely you're going to start running into dragon cards, and if you get three dragon cards, that's the end of the round, and that could be early in the game, could be late in the game, and a guaranteed ding. Raw is another great example of that, where you have 30 tiles in the bag. When all those tiles come out, it's game over instantly. But when will they come out? Will the first round be long? Will the first round be short? Will all rounds be equally long? It's kind of adds to the flavor of the experience.
And both Raw and Ethnos are in between. They're like variable through luck, but also player driven, because you have a choice in Raw whether you draw or not. And similarly in Ethnos, you can have a choice of whether or not you draw. So if you're drawing from the top of the deck in Ethnos a lot, I think that makes it more likely, right?
Yeah, I suppose.
Like, there's some amount of like, or at least you can decide in Ethnos to draw cards or play them. And if you're choosing to draw a lot, you're running the timer down. So it's like a mix of both.
Is there a purely variable end state without player?
Yeah, high society, right? Like, no, you are forced after every auction, you must flip a card. True. Like, there's no choice. Do I flip the card or not? Yeah.
Is it worth like talking about like pros and cons or something, or like, is there, I'm trying to think of where we dig in next.
I think the con to variability is the lack of control and the seeming randomness that the whole experience gets as a result of that. As much as I love high society, and I do love high society, I have played it with people who have said that they didn't enjoy it just because it almost gives them anxiety not knowing when stuff's going to come out. Like, you could literally have a game where you just get 2x multipliers, negative points, and the game is over because all those cards have come out. It's not likely to happen, but it's come close to happening to us a couple of times, and that can kind of lead to a feeling of less agency for the players.
I think you can still feel control if it's variable but player driven. But yeah, when it's variable and basically totally luck driven like high society, I agree with you. You can feel like it's chaotic or you don't have control. It definitely leans into tactile gaming as opposed to strategic gaming, for sure.
Which is interesting, because I think you still feel like you have a lot more agency as a player in a game with a fixed length.
Right.
Even though you actually have less agency in that, because no matter what you do, the game is still going to end at the same time.
Yeah, to me, the big con of games without a fixed end is just if they'd start to drag out, right? Like, if people don't do the right things to push that end or whatever, that can start to really, really turn a game sour, or, you know, just like turn the experience around if it just like drags on.
A lot of games that have victory points as a threshold run that risk, because that's player driven. But it's also, maybe that, I don't know, my brain kind of wants to make that its own axis, where victory points are a threshold, or victory point end condition is a threshold, because it feels like a fixed length, because you know exactly how many points you need to win. But it is obviously player driven, because the players are the ones generating their points.
I disagree. I think it's just a player-driven variable. Because when we say fixed length, we mean like game time units, right? Like, you know it'll be 12 rounds or whatever, 12 turns. So,
yes, true.
And they almost always have a fixed goal, like draw 3 dragon cards. Like, you know that, you know? Just like the points. But yeah, I agree that points does feel different, maybe because it just like so directly correlates with what you're trying to do. I agree that it's like, it's worth separating that out, but I think it's still under the umbrella of variable player driven.
Yeah.
I think a lot of like purely player driven things usually it is victory points, right? It's like, okay, first to 20 points, 30 points, whatever it be, you know, and then how well you are at getting points kind of determines how long this game is going to go, or how many, a lot of times like players will, how many players are in a game. It's like, well, if it takes me just as long to get points, but now I have to wait twice as long to get my turn, you know, every turn, like it just takes it longer.
Mm-hmm. We're kind of talking about this in a way that is implying a single endgame trigger, but I'm finding a lot of games now have 1 to 3, maybe even 4 endgame triggers. You get into some of those big box assertas where there's like 8 endgame triggers, which can be a little bit overwhelming to grok. I feel like it's a brute to balance, but it's also very difficult to internalize as a player. But I think that's where a lot of those hit a certain point thresholds get used, because it's kind of like, eh, if you've hit 200 points, you've probably been playing this for a while, so yeah, you can end the game at that point.
I like Nucleum quite a bit, but that suffers from that in such an annoying way. There's 5 different endgame triggers, and like every other question is, when does the game end again? There's like so many different ways, and they, I really don't want to say this in a negative way, but it's just going to come out that way. They feel lazy, where it's like, if the contracts run out, the game's done, because what do you do then? If the track tiles run out, the game's over, because what do you do then? If somebody hits 70 points, they probably won, or, you know, like that one feels a bit more legit, but there's so many where just like a thing runs out. And it's like, I guess, yeah, because what do you do then? Sure, but it's very, very annoying to keep track of.
Yeah.
And it makes the game less exciting near the end. Like with those games that have a single endgame condition, which, you know, Kanitia is so good at, everybody's just like eyeing that one condition. Like there's so much focus on the table, just staring at the track in Raw, or the number of cars that have come out in High Society, or how long the row is in Botswana.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's just a thing that you can like zone in on and pay attention to. And when there's more than two, you lose so much tension, I feel.
Yeah. I actually think 2's a really good number for endgame triggers, because you have like the obvious one, usually with 2. You have like the main one, the one that everyone's gunning for. And then you have this one off to the side. An example of that for a game I just picked up, haven't played it yet, but I'm very excited to, is Imperium Horizons, where the main endgame trigger is the main draw deck being depleted. Makes sense. To your point, what are you going to do when you run out of cards? You're just going to end the game, going to go do something else. But there's also a second deck of unrest cards, which kind of represent, you know, your growing discontent in your civilization. And if that deck ever runs out, the entire endgame structure shifts. You don't really count points. You don't really worry about what anybody's done. Mm-hmm. It's just whoever has the most unrest loses the game.
Right. And I think the two make sense if they also lead to different victory calculations, right? Like that's when it's the most exciting, where it's like, yeah, 85% of the time the game ends normally, we calculate points, but and Byzantium has this too, where like if somebody takes over Constantinople, the game's also done, and then it, like all that matters I think are your Arab victory points, and you don't care about your other side. So those are definitely fun, and they lead to like this element or this maybe hope or worry or anxiety that there's a small chance that this could go horribly wrong and everything you've done doesn't matter. It's all about some other condition.
It also magnifies mechanics that would otherwise maybe feel a little tertiary or like kind of off to the side.
Yeah.
What about, I'm thinking about Splendor Duel is the one that came to mind, where there's, I want to say 3 or 4 ways that you can like win the game right away. And those, I mean, there are times where I kind of, like, playing it, I've sort of felt like, okay, wait, oh, yeah, there's that whole other way that you can win, too. You know, like, I kind of, it is a little, feels a little hard to hold all 3 or 4 of them in my head. But at the same time, they seem like very clear, like, strategies. And so it kind of gives the game, like, more paths to victory or strategies you can try. Like, there's the, well, you can get 10 points in one color, or you can just get, like, 20 points in general, or you can collect, like, 10 of these little crown things. And I swear to God, there's one more I can't think of right now. But, like... It's just like, you know, which way you want to go. Like once you pick one, you can kind of just focus on it. And then maybe you would be like, oh, wait, crap. I actually did pick up 6 points in green already. Maybe I just shift to that. You know, like it, you don't have to really focus on all of them. It just kind of gives you a direction without being like, this is the only way to do it.
That's also a thing in Seven Wonders Duel and same co-designer. And I think in 2-player games, it's really nice because if I pick a lane and I go for it, and you pick a different lane and you go for it, we have to defend the other person's lane at the same time. So I think it's like especially valuable, I guess, in two-player games to have these multiple win conditions.
As much as I like it, you using that example, Steve, has me thinking of Inish, which is both a good example of how to do multiple win conditions well, but also how not to do it, because it's well because it's just have six of one of these three things, but the three things are all very different. It's either have majority in an area where you are ruling over six other players, meeples, have six sanctuary buildings, or have yourself in six different areas. But it also makes that game very hard to internalize because it's like, okay, I know I need six of something, but is it like six units all in one place? No, that's not one of the win conditions. Oh, is it six fortresses? No, that also doesn't matter at all. Yeah, I need six of this thing, though.
I'm also thinking about, well, we've been talking a lot about endgame triggers that are victory conditions, but also there's endgame triggers that are not victory conditions. And I think that can lead people to be a little bit confused. So, for example, in Moon Rollers, the game ends when you get like five different cards.
Yeah.
And then people always ask me when I'm demoing it, do I win? I'm like, no, no, you still have to calculate points. So there's like something ingrained in us that the person who ends the game wins, which maybe is true like historically, like if we think about old abstract games, right? Like chess is over when somebody wins.
Candyland? There's
no points or anything. Yeah. Candyland is over when somebody wins, right? Candyland and chess are just
basically the same game.
The most opposite games, but so similar in that respect. I love that. So yeah, I'm just saying that we're considering victory condition and end condition as one and the same, but they're not always one and the same.
Yeah, that what you just mentioned is fairly more common nowadays, but yeah, that's definitely not like uncommon that the game ends and then you count score. But you're right that, like there is that, like, I think the classic way, or the way that's still maybe like the default assumption is, oh, I ended the game, I must win. Yeah, that's interesting.
It's true though, because I do think there are some feelings of that when I end the game of, do I really want to end the game right now because I don't think I'm going to win? Am I just going to give somebody else the win? And that can feel weird because it's the decision where it's like, if I don't end the game, they're going to end the game. But I'm not going to get enough points to end the game. And that can kind of feel weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, it can be a good kind of tension, but it also can be like a weird, like in the world of the game, it's weird to think about like, okay, I'm going to hold back now because time is going to stop.
The other thing that I don't think a lot of people consider, especially in the early days of their involvement in the hobby, but even later days, because this is something I still don't necessarily think about. A game like Pipeline wears on its sleeve just how tight the action economy is, because it's three rounds, but the rounds get shorter. Agricola is another example of that, where it's like six rounds, but by round five, it's like, okay, we take one turn, then the round's over. But I was playing a game of Hegemony yesterday, and that's a five-round game. You get five actions each round. So it just feels like you get a lot of actions, but if you break it down, you actually only get 25 actions over the course of the whole game. And that can kind of lead to some of the experience of it, because it feels like at the start of the game, oh, I got five rounds to do all this stuff that I want to do. And it's obviously narrowing down how much you can do over the course of the game. But because it's fixed length, you don't necessarily realize how tight the action economy is going to be, because it's not waving it in your face how tight it's going to be.
Yeah, I don't know if this is kind of tangential, but you mentioned like it, a variable end maybe being a little tougher to like grok for like a first-time player. I feel like that happens a lot where you play a game and you're like, okay, the game ends when we get through all these tiles. And people are like going, they're doing stuff, they're doing, and then all of a sudden there's only four tiles left. And they're like, oh, I see. That's how fast this goes. Yeah. You know, like getting that sense of how much game do you get out of 60 tiles, you know?
Yeah, that's actually a good way of hiding a tight action economy, is if you place a tile every turn and you have 24 tiles, it's like, oh, I got this huge stack of tiles in front of me. This game's going to go forever. But because that's the only thing you do on your turn is place a tile, that's going to go pretty quickly unless you're playing with people that have severe analysis paralysis. Going back to what we were saying before about the end game trigger often getting conflated with the win condition, I think a really good example of that is the Palaces of Carrera, because the only way to trigger the end game is for someone to have achieved all four objectives. mm-hmm. but achieving all four objectives does not mean you're going to necessarily win. And that is a head trip to get around.
You do get points, though, for ending it in that game, don't you?
I believe you do.
And I think a lot of games give you points for ending it when they're worried that the game is too much in the player's hands, that they need to incentivize you a bit more. Like, I wonder if that's always a Band-Aid, where like there isn't that victory point gain at the end if you end it, but then people don't end it. And they're like, okay, fine, we'll give you 10 points. And then people start ending it more often. So I think if the game is player-controlled like it is in Carrara, there usually is a bit of that boost to the person who ends it just to push you towards ending it and preventing the game from dragging on too much. We didn't really talk about the pros of the different systems, though.
No.
I think we talked about cons. But if we're saying our three different systems are fixed, variable luck-driven, variable player-driven, right? Like, when do we like the uses of these? Like, when do they feel like they're appropriate for the game? When are they inappropriate for the style of game that you find them in?
I think that a variable ending, we kind of said this, but I think it can be really exciting. Yeah. Like that tension of like, ooh, is it going to end now? When's it going to end? Do I have enough time to get this in there? I don't know. Like that usually is pretty fun. It can be stressful or maybe turn against you in some ways, but like I think it adds a nice tension. So
it adds like another element to play on where you're like, I need the game to end now because I'm in the lead and they're, you know, catching up, so I have to do the thing that pushes the end game, and often that doesn't necessarily win me points. So it's like, is it worth doing that? And people start noticing, like, oh, he's trying to push the end game, like block him here so he can't do X, right? That those kind of moments are really fun where you're like strategizing around the timing of the game. So it adds that element of strategy as well.
It adds drama because it's something that you can plan to have three more turns, and the game and maybe the players interacting with the game will absolutely dumpster that plan. And so it can really add to some of the table talk and some of the excitement, to your point, of the game ending, as opposed to just being sort of this thing that starts out really great and then sort of fizzles. Dune Imperium.
Right. Drama is almost defined by the range in its highs and lows, right? Or like, so like a very dramatic game is one that can end in 5 rounds or in 15.
Yeah.
Whereas a less dramatic game is like a guaranteed ending in 12. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also like a limit. Like 1 to 50 is no longer dramatic. It's like annoying at that point where I don't know if I'm going to sit down for 10 minutes or 3 hours. So there's certainly a range that you have to, you know, be within. But I think generally the variety increases drama. Yeah.
Here's a thought. You have a really heavy Euro game, or even just a medium Euro game, like a Kanban or whatever. But it has a variable endgame trigger that is luck-driven. Is that satisfying? Because those games are kind of built on perfect information or near-perfect information where you know exactly what's going to happen, when it's going to happen. Does that detract from some of the fun? Because if you know you're going to have roughly like 14, 15 rounds, you can plan around that. But if you don't know how many rounds you're going to have, you can't plan around it. So you're just kind of planning for a ideal game length.
I mean, isn't that Oath? Isn't that what started this conversation?
It is. I realized halfway through my sentence that I was basically describing Oath.
It's not a Euro, though, right?
No, it's a Oath war game.
Like, we're talking about like a heavy meaty, resource though. Management, like logistics style game where planning is everything, right?
Fair.
I can't think of any that have luck driven. I can think of plenty that have player driven variable end games, but none that are luck driven. Yeah.
Like I'm imagining, going back to the Kanban example, you have that deck of cards with the different resources on it to generate the garage stockpile. And one of those is just foreclosure, so you never know if that's going to come out. That would definitely change the way you're interacting with the garage in that game.
I think people who like those games would hate it because they like those games for the planning they provide, right? Like being like the satisfaction is seeing a plan through to the end. That's what's exciting about those games, I think, for people who love them.
I'm kind of thinking I would love that, though, in that game. And I love Kanban the way that it is, but I'm just imagining the tension and terror every time someone goes to get more parts to build a car. It's like, please don't foreclose. Please don't foreclose.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think, I know in some of those games you often hear of people being like, oh, if I just had like one more turn, when it's like a player driven variable still, you know, like you still get some of that, like, oh, if I only had a little, you know, like I didn't know exactly when it was going to end, if I could have just, but that's even, that's not necessarily, oh, I didn't think it was going to end, I didn't plan. It's just sort of like, ah, I just didn't have enough turns, you know, like I knew the end was coming. I knew 3 turns ago I wasn't going to have enough, but,
I think that's the interesting thing about something like a Nuclear Mori. You have that second endgame trigger that you know is going to have to happen. I agree that it's like Nuclear's bloated with endgame triggers. But the first one hits, it's like, okay, so we might have 3 more rounds or we might have 2 depending on what everybody does. Or maybe this will be the last round because someone's just going to go hard and get a bunch of contracts. So, yeah, I guess that is an example of not luck. It is still player driven, but it's almost... If it's a 4-player game of Nuclear, it almost feels like luck because who knows what these guys are going to do? Are they just going to end the game because they know that they're going to win with endgame scoring? Who knows?
Shuffle and Swing is also like that.
Yeah.
It's that's the first thing I thought of when you said a Euro game with a variable endgame trigger, but luck driven.
I can't think of
there's
an example.
Gotta be one.
Yeah,
I feel like people hated it so much that they just buried it in under bad BGG reviews. Like that's why we don't. Like somebody must have done it, but I think people would have hated it because the pro of the fixed is that you can plan.
Yeah,
that's what it provides you. It provides you with planning.
Yeah,
I think another pro there is just you can plan like outside of the game world, right? Like just hey, we have an hour to play a game. Can we fit this one in? Yes, because it's 10 turns. You know, like I know it's gonna and. Maybe exactly how long it lasts, you know, can be squishy depending on the people, but like, you know, it's not going to just drag out forever.
Non-variable fixed is really great for both getting in and out, but also, like I said off the top, I really like it for onboarding people onto an experience because there's not that extra layer of understanding and the rules that you have to get. I can just say, yep, it's 10 turns. We do this, you know, go around the table 10 times, game's over.
So for impromptu segment, we are doing our favorite endgame trigger, and I'll bestow the honor upon Steven to go first.
Oh boy. Well, that's probably best because mine's not gonna be very exciting. It's just High Society.
Ding
ding.
I love the tension of that one, and I love it because it's already a quick game, so you never have to worry about it dragging out. And You don't like stack the deck at all, right? Like you don't make sure that one of them's in like the back half or something. Yeah, I think that can be really handy too. Something like an Ethnos, because I'm pretty sure there you do it, right?
Yeah.
Like you make sure one of the dragons is at least like a third or halfway down there or something, so it doesn't just like end immediately. But I love the tension of, oh, is it going to end? When's it going to end? And then you even have the excitement when it doesn't end, right? Like when you think, for sure it's going to end here. We only have 3 cards left. For sure it's going to be this one. And then it's not. It's like the last card that ends it. Like that can be super exciting and dramatic in a different way. But it's all within the range of, you know, a tight game. So, I mean, I'm looking through my list, you know, trying to think of something that gives me more satisfaction or excitement. And it's hard to top. So I think that's just got to be mine. I will say, I know I brought up the Turncoats and Pax Penning last time. I think it's fascinating in Pax Penning. I haven't played it, so that's why I can't say it's like my favorite or something, but there's a couple things. There's some variable stuff that ends like when you get through a certain number of rounds, and even that can be kind of random, but like at the end of the game, you can like if the winning player, if you have more of your stones in their house, then you kind of like steal the victory from them. So I think that's also really fascinating, like this idea that like, oh, you can win, but since I have so much control over your house, I actually win.
Ooh, I like that.
I kind of wish we'd played more PAX games going into this conversation, because I feel like PAX games are filled with bizarre card markets and bonkers endgame triggers and win conditions.
That's true. Pax Premier is a pretty, pretty fun one too. So, all right. Good call, Evan.
So
what do you guys got?
I technically have 3, but I'm going to spare you all hearing about Raw and my love of Raw, the game that went from being like nowhere on my radar to a top 3 game in the course of like 6 months. Ding away, haters. I love Raw and I'm a proud man who loves Raw. The actual one, though, I'm going to go with is Captain Sonar. It's a player-driven endgame trigger where it's also the win condition. So you sink somebody else's submarine, you win. But all the drama and all the tension of, are we actually going to hit their submarine when you fire that torpedo, is unlike anything else in all of board gaming. Gaming, period. Like, even a video game doesn't really quite capture what happens when you are taking that last shot. The last time I played Captain Sonar, it was very close. Both submarines were down to one hit point. And I was sitting next to my radio operator, who is basically drawing out on this clear piece of plastic where they think the other submarine is. And what I didn't know was she had accidentally shifted the sheet one space over. So I'm like, are they there for sure? She's like, yes. But what she didn't say was, we need to adjust the sheet. And so we fired, and both sides are about to fire, and we're sure we got them. And we missed them by one space, and they hit us. And that sounds like it would, you know, maybe be a bad time, but it was just so perfect of a way to end that with just all the chaos that had happened leading up to that moment. It really does feel like the experience is funneled down into this last crescendo moment. And I love Captain Sonar because of that.
What was your other one? You had three. He lied.
No, I did have
he
a third
to
one.
All of our, he I lied to our faces.
I was so excited to talk about Captain Sonar. Come back to me if I think of it.
All right. Well, mine is Shuffle and Swing.
Let's go.
Which is coming to Kickstarter on April 9th, in case you're wondering.
Tell us about it, Robert.
Throughout the course of the game, you're building three instruments, which kind of act as three mini area majority competitions. And at the end of the game, you're going to score for the stuff you've put on the instruments. But the game ends when two of the three are built. And you only score the points on the two that have been built. So the whole time you're anxious about making sure the instrument you're most invested in is the one that actually ends up scoring. And on the one that is unbuilt at the end, you actually score negative points if you're the person who's bragged the least about it. So there's always this worry that you might end up taking the negative hit. And if you take the negative hit, you're basically not winning. So it's not a victory. Like, it's not if you end the game, you win. But if the game ends in a way that you specifically did not want it to, you're not going to win. So it's like you're guaranteed to lose, I think, if you take a lot of negative points.
Yeah, I really like the end game of Shuffle and Swing. It's always spicy.
Yeah, that'd be my pick, truly. I was going to say Cat Blues, but I've talked about Cat Blues so much that I just won't say Cat Blues.
I remember what the third one was now. You just reminded me. Depleting the bank and food chain magnet, because most of the game is building up to one turn where you just get all the points, hoover them all up, and as soon as there's no more points to get, it's over. Cat Blues reminded me of that. Thank you. They basically just ripped off Kanitsia.
Every game has ripped off Kanitsia. Chess, backgammon, go. These are all Kanitsia. Yeah, I think that's it. Thank you for listening. If you like what we do, tell a friend, and then they can also listen along. With that being said, my name's Robert.
Don't forget to support Robert on Kickstarter, GameFound, and pretty much every other platform known to man.
Evan. My name is Robert.
My name is Evan.
I'm Steve.
No, you guys did it at the same time. All right, take three.
Oh my God.
My name's Robert.
My name's Evan.
And I'm Steve.
There we go. See you guys in 2 weeks.
Play some games.